This is Bristol Band Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, February 12th. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, a conversation with a new Department of Corrections commissioner in light of an assault at a state jail that left a Dillingham man hospitalized this week.
We are stretched thin in locations. And part of my job is to figure out with my team and what we're going to do about it.
Bear tracks have been popping up around the area. We'll go on the hunt for Ursus sightings and whatever else might be leaving prints out there.
It looked like a rather large human footprint with five toes right alongside the road.
The Malamutes christened the new gym in New Haven last night.
It was a packed house, and just having the capacity to have all those people there comfortably and safely was wonderful.
Plus, we'll introduce Dillingham's new prosecutor. And ahead of Valentine's Day, we ask a few folks what's made the difference in their love lives through the years.
Well, her cooking has certainly gotten better.
Oh, my gosh. Is that the reason you're sticking around? Oh, no. Well, I'm sick of cooking.
Those stories are coming up after a brief look back at some of the week's news. Both teams from Bristol Bay took the title at the Battle of the Bay in Dillingham last weekend, topping the boys and girls teams from Dillingham in Saturday's final matchups. Angels boys team coach Brian Anderson said the weekend's win was a much-needed morale booster for his team.
You know, a number of things went well for us. We didn't particularly play very well, but we played really hard, and we went through a lot of adversity, and we grew as a team this weekend, and I was mostly happy with our defense this weekend.
In Juneau Monday, the House signaled its intention to buckle down and tackle the budget crisis facing the state. With the passing of Concurrent Resolution 23 by a vote of 38-1, the House suspended most other business except that which is related to spending and revenue until such a time as an operating budget is passed. Bryce Edgman from Dillingham helped push the measure into place.
Now we have the opportunity to just focus primarily on the budget for the next 2 to 3 weeks and do everything we possibly can to make some very, very tough decisions, both on the reduction of the budget side of the equation as well as the new revenues side that we need to look at.
The minority Democrats extended an olive branch to the majority this week as well, offering to form a caucus of the whole to meet the historical challenges. Les Guerra is a Democrat from Anchorage.
What I would expect is that they drop their ideological predispositions. We drop our ideological predispositions, and we compromise on a plan to fill a $3.6, $3.7 billion budget hole in a way that's fair to everybody, not just fair to the rich, not just fair to corporations, but fair to everybody.
The Republicans said they would consider the idea. The Senate majority grew larger by one this week, with Republicans welcoming Donnie Olson from Golovin back into their ranks. Olson is a Democrat, but will join Lyman Hoffman from Bethel as rural Democrats who choose to caucus with the majority. As cities around the state take steps to develop policy for the commercial growing and sale of marijuana, many Bristol Bay communities seem still a bit flat-footed. Dillingham finally set a marijuana advisory committee, which will take the pulse of the town and offer recommendations to the city council members. Alice Ruby had this to say at last week's city council meeting.
The first task for the committee will be to get educated on the state law and what the city's obligations are. And we did feel that the council should try to get educated as well by sitting in on these committees. And that way we kind of stay up so that when the committee does bring us recommendations, we'll know what they're based on.
The state will begin accepting commercial applications on February 24th, but those will take up to 3 months to process. How rural commercial operations will have their products mandatorily tested has still not been determined. Alaska's Division of Insurance announced an agreement with insurer Moda Health to allow the company to stay on the individual and group markets in Alaska. Director Lori Wing-Heyer says she's asking the federal government to open a special 2-week enrollment period to accommodate Alaskans who couldn't buy Moda plans ahead of the January 31st deadline.
We know there are people that had finished their enrollment but then got to a point where they could not pay or could not finalize it. And for those people that are still kind of in a limbo, we're hoping that CMS will give us a 2-week period, a 2-week special enrollment to allow those people to finalize and choose Moda as their insurer.
In other news this week, on Tuesday afternoon at the Wildwood Correctional Center, inmate Vaughn Clark, a 40-year-old from Dillingham, was assaulted and medevaced to Anchorage with life-threatening injuries. State authorities say he is still hospitalized and have released few other details about the assault. State troopers are investigating. the chief of the Barrow Fire Department and nephew of Representative Ben Nagyak, was shot and killed by police this week. The North Slope Borough told the Alaska Dispatch yesterday that Vincent Nagyak III was involved in a domestic disturbance, and when police arrived on scene, he allegedly pointed a shotgun in their direction. Investigating troopers have released few details. And the Yukon Quest is now more than halfway over, with last year's champ Brent Sass currently in the lead. Sass was the first out of Dawson City, the halfway point where mushers take a mandatory 36-hour rest. He left just after midnight Yukon time, followed by Alan Moore, Hugh Neff, and Matt Hall. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. This week, a man from Dillingham who was in custody at a jail in Kenai was assaulted. He was medevaced with life-threatening injuries to Anchorage. We don't have many official details yet, but the incident raised concerns again about safety inside of Alaska's jails. Last summer, Governor Bill Walker commissioned a report of Alaska's correctional facilities, and that report, published in November, has prompted the governor to promise reforms. One of his first actions was appointing one of the report's two authors to head up the corrections department. Dean Williams has spent three decades working for the state, mostly in the Department of Corrections and Law. He took over as DOC commissioner on January 28th and now oversees the custody and care of approximately 5,000 inmates in state jails, as well as 700 to 800 more in community jails around the state. I spoke with Williams yesterday, asking first for more information about the incident at the Wildwood Corrections Center.
I just have some of the initial reports from it, so I'm reluctant to draw any major conclusions because I really want to wait till everything comes in for my review. But in terms of the initial reports, it appears that, you know, inmate assaulted another inmate. The victim inmate in that case was found unresponsive by staff. Life-saving measures were implemented immediately. The victim in that case is still alive. I know our chaplains and et cetera are over with the family or at the hospital. It's an assault that occurred out of sight, I believe, out of any of the correction officers or anyone monitoring. That's about all I know right now.
How do these things happen? Are there staffing shortages, too many inmates to too few guards, or what do you see overall now that you're in this position that allow for these sort of dangerous incidents to occur?
Well, in these particular, and I don't know, there are different reasons for different incidents. I'm not sure that any of the things that applied in this recent case had to do with staffing. I just don't know that yet. You know, inmates interact with each other in locations, and while they're under general supervision, depending on what status they are, they're either in a more closer-knit supervision, or if they're in general population, you know, they play cards and, you know, they're accessible, they can go to the bathroom, and, you know, they don't have to be escorted, they're out in open living areas, and so there's general supervision in populations. It could be one correction officer and 50, 60, 70, 80 inmates sometimes. You know, it's too early to know whether or not there was something that was really amiss or whether or not this was just a really strategic assault. I just don't know that yet. You know, staffing and supervision in these places is huge. It's everything. And we are stretched thin in locations. And part of my job is to figure out with my leadership team what we're going to do about it. There's not a lot of options, and none of them are very good. You either reallocate resources to increase staffing, or one of the other, you know, very unsavory options is that you have to contemplate moving people back out of state. So my job over the next few months is to see what we can reallocate, where we're really the thinnest. But I'm not sure that was the case, what we're dealing with in Wildwood.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's fair to say that most Alaskans, you know, we expect that if individuals are turned over to the custody of the state to serve time for isolation, for rehabilitation, we expect them to be safe while they're there. Can you briefly sum up what your priorities are as you get going here as commissioner to bring about some of the reforms that you and the governor signal are coming?
Well, I'll take them in. The safety of the institutions is paramount. there's just nothing else that can replace job number one. I'm very invested in the justice reform work that's in place, and I'm extremely supportive of it because I think it's going to help not only in terms of the entire justice system, but also help the prison system. So I'm very much for that work, but safety absolutely is the priority, and there's several ways of, you know, that I'm going to move forward in terms of getting there. The first thing is having the right team in place. I've made a difficult decision this week of asking for resignations for both of my deputy commissioners. They're wonderful people, fantastic people. I've gotten to know them. I have great respect for them. But I need people to have certain expertise in areas in terms of going forward. So for me, it's really a matter of the who first, who is going to be with me on my team. That's the first thing. The second thing is that standing up an independent internal investigation unit is critically important to understand what problems you have. One of the critiques that Joe Hanlon and I put in the report was that if you don't have independent investigations, you can never really figure out what happened wrong. The third thing is that I'm going to focus on policies and training a great deal. You know, we also in the report critiqued the fact that our policies were quite out of date. That's going to take time. I mean, that's probably a year's worth of work, as much as I hate to acknowledge that. It's true. It's just because you can't write policies and just change the dates on them. You have to make sure that that's, in fact, what makes sense now. And some of these policies go back to the 80s. It's those and some other issues, of course, that I'm going to focus heavily on. You know, I've also spoke of segregation and my concern about segregation and what that does to our population and how damaging that is to people. There's not one magic, you know, silver bullet to this equation. There's multiple things that have to be done, I think, to make a safer prison system.
Dean Williams is the commissioner of Alaska's Department of Corrections, appointed to the post at the end of January by Governor Bill Walker. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Last night, a lot of folks gathered in New Haven, both for some good basketball action as part of the Roadhouse Rumble tournament, but also to cut the ribbon and christen the long-awaited, much-improved gymnasium at the school. Superintendent of Schools, Lake and Penn Schools, that is, Ty Mace, was still in New Haven this morning, where we caught up with him for an update. Ty, good to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, good morning, Dave.
How big of an improvement is this for New Haven?
Well, as a lot of people know, New Haven's a basketball community, and there's a lot of ball that goes on in this over the years in this very small gym up here, and a lot of times the kids would play late into the evening. And with the new gym, the full-size court and the side courts, they're going to be able to run practices at the same time, get kids home earlier, and just have a nicer facility for the community to enjoy.
The borough voters actually adopted paying for this through a bond measure a couple of years ago, along with the Port Allsworth School. What did this cost?
You know, I hesitate to say the final numbers aren't in yet. I can say that we did it as economically as possible in these tough financial times. It was several million dollars, but it's a beautiful addition to the school.
What stands out to you, and what do you think stood out to folks who have been able to see it and watch some basketball games?
You know, I think the size of the gym. It was hard to fathom last night what it would look like if we cut that gym in half and tried to pack all of those people and all of those teams, and you know, the original size of the old facility. It was a packed house last night, and just having the capacity to have all those people there comfortably and safely was wonderful. With the highlight being that the court is dedicated. It's Coach Bob's court. Bob Rutnowski's been in this community for 30-plus years.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Bob? I understand he was a longtime coach that is credited with a lot of the success the basketball program in New Haven has today.
Yeah, Bob is just hands down a class act. He's more than a coach. There's a lot of just great young men in this community and men in general, and a lot of that is is Bob's coaching, and he does more than just coaches basketball. He raises up great young men. Last night at Lester, actually had for the ribbon cutting ceremony, Bob cut the ribbon, and Ed asked for all of his former players in the stands to come down and join him with his current team on the floor. And it was just really a special moment to watch men young and old come out of the stands to join Bob and dedicate the court to Bob.
How did the New Haven Malamutes do last night in the christening games in their new gym?
They did great. They did great. The girls had a very solid victory. The boys played extremely hard against New Stu, and it was just one of those incredible games. New Stu came out on top, but everybody was standing and clapping for the New Haven Malamutes. They just played really well, and it was a great game. No regrets.
Let's leave it right there. Ty Mace is the superintendent of the Lake and Peninsula School District. Ty, thanks so much for the update today.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Dave.
It was just over a week ago that Punxsutawney Phil failed to see his shadow foretelling of an early spring. That's hardly news to us in Bristol Bay, where the damp, mild winter already feels a bit like April. But it's not rodents that are giving us hints of warmer times to come. KDLG's Hannah Colton brings us two stories of creatures woken from their winter slumbers in the past week or so, one at the Dillingham Dump and one in Cockanock.
The bear came up almost as an afterthought during February's city council meeting. City manager Rose Loetta was telling the council that Public Works is planning to build a new trash cell at the landfill. She explained, to make room for the new cell, they have to clear 7 acres of trees.
Public Works' heavy equipment operators will remove the trees and then we'll stack them for people to come and cut them down. We were going to have them cut the trees down themselves, but the bear is still out there and has been seen.
Wait a minute. A bear out there? Isn't it February? I had to wonder if this was some kind of post-Groundhog's Day joke. So I called up Public Works Director Francisco Pancho Garcia. He told me it's true. He went and confirmed some bear tracks out there last week. But he wasn't sure who actually spotted the tracks or first made the report.
We just get calls here at Public Works, and they don't leave their name, numbers, or nothing. They just call and leave a message, and, well, we go take a look at it.
So I headed out to the landfill Wednesday morning to see what I could see and to meet up with Fish and Game wildlife biologist Neil Barton. Barton has been described in the past as a bear buster for his years of experience dealing with bear-human interactions in Juneau and elsewhere. But this morning, he seems stumped.
Yeah, I just went back to the landfill and looked around for any sign of the bear itself, scat, tracks. I did not see anything, so I went over to the shack where one of the landfill employees hangs out.
I went and talked to this employee, too.
Brian Hoffman. I haven't seen the bear since November, maybe middle of November.
We did learn one important thing from Hoffman. The likely identity of the bear. Remember back in late August, early September, when a skinny-looking bear was hanging out by the airport Y? Bear Rock Oberma might sound familiar.
Was it that one with the crazy, like, lip thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He, as soon as he got done with Squaw Creek, he's been out here ever since. So.
How was he looking in November?
Big and fat. Healthy.
So, still no eyewitnesses to our bear in February. I asked Barton, how unusual is it to have a bear wandering around in the dead of winter? He said it's strange, but not unheard of. There have been sightings near Togiak, Kalignik, and King Salmon in the past couple months, and the mild winter probably has something to do with it.
I was curious about the temperature thing in particular. Like, do they really get tricked into thinking it's like time to come out, or is that not quite how it works?
I think it's more of a daylight thing. I think it's more based on, the length of the days, and as we get the longer days in the spring, that's really what triggers them to get up. But temperature could certainly have something to do with it, partly because if it's warm and things are melting, at least what I've heard from other biologists is you start getting dripping and water running into some of the dens, and it gets a little uncomfortable, so the bear gets up and moves about, maybe even goes and looks for a different spot to lay down. So that can lead to that too. But, I think it's more a daylight thing.
So, back on the trail. Two other landfill employees I talked to said they'd seen the bear earlier this winter, but nothing as recently as last week. So I took my question to the one place in Dillingham you're bound to get a response. I posted it on the Dillingham Trading Post Facebook page and got my answer about an hour later.
Hello?
Hi, is this Brian?
This is.
This is Brian McCumber. He's a mechanic for the city of Dillingham. His work takes him out to the dump pretty often. So what I first heard was that somebody had seen fresh tracks like a week ago. But I haven't been able to actually confirm that with anyone.
I've been off all this week, so I know I haven't seen anything this week. But week previous, Darren Woods and myself, he's the other fleet mechanic for the city.
McCumber and his coworker have some scrap metal and old tires to get rid of. They head out to the dump cells, kind of an isolated spot toward the back of the landfill.
And when we went down there, we noticed that there was carcasses on the ground. It looked like somebody had skinned a couple of carcasses, and there were indeed bear tracks in the snow. I'm assuming he was there in the morning before Joe got there with the excavator and making noise and pulling down trees. And that was just last week.
Okay, awesome. That's good to hear that that rumor is confirmed then. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
The feast should go on, as long as Barak keeps his or her fear of heavy machinery. My second story of a mysterious print this month comes from Gary Nielsen in Kakanak.
It was a couple of weeks ago. My wife and granddaughter were walking up to my mother's house along the road, which is about a quarter mile away, and they called me and told me to come up and look at this track across from the fire hall on the main road. So my son and I went up to look at it, and it looked like a rather large human footprint with five toes right alongside the road.
He says the oversized track was frozen into the ground when they found it. But a couple of days before, it had been warmer, rainy. And Nielsen remembers the night he thinks something was out prowling, because he says all the dogs in town were going bonkers.
I have a female with pups in our windbreak, and she's a very good watchdog. She'll chase everything away that's human, human-like or animal, but this time she would not come out of her out of the windbreak. So who knows? It's probably something I would not want to run into in the dark of night.
Legends of the hairy man, the 9-foot-tall, shaggy man creature, are all over the place in the Iliamna area, and especially around Kakanak. And Nielsen says the end of January is about the right time for hairy men to start being active.
The only time that there really is not any sightings is like from the end of November to the end of January. And we're guessing that they either hibernate or partially hibernate for those, at least those 2 months.
Okay. So the weird thing was really that it was so close to, like, houses and stuff?
Yes. The ones we have seen in the past were always outside of the villages. Very rarely ever an encounter within the village boundaries, quote-unquote. And if it's within the village boundaries, that's, the old-timers say that's not good because they're looking for something.
Huh. So are people kind of, like, freaked out on alert, or do you think other people are know about it?
It's just something that you watch out for, not really out on alert. It's just that you just have to be careful. They say not to hurt them in any way, not to be threatening to them. If you hurt one, they all will know. If you threaten them, they all will know. And your butt may not be guaranteed for a while. But so it's best not to take any chances.
My takeaway here is that the experts' advice is the same with winter bears and hairy men. Don't mess with them, and they probably won't mess with you. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Criminal cases filed through the Dillingham Court have a new prosecutor. Her name is Pamela Dale, and she stopped by this week after wrapping up her first trial in town, which was coincidentally the first trial at the new courthouse on Emperor Way. Pam, good to have you in. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Would you introduce yourself a bit?
Yes. My name, again, is Pamela Dale. I'm an assistant district attorney with the state of Alaska, and I am assigned to the Dillingham jurisdiction, the Bristol Bay jurisdiction, Togiak, and all the surrounding communities. Whatever community the Dillingham district attorney's office covers, they've been assigned to me.
Dale tells me she's been in Alaska since the mid-70s and went to college in the mid-80s at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
When I started undergraduate, I started to do this job. I didn't go to college just to get a college degree. I went to college so that I could go to law school so that I could be a prosecutor. And I went to the University of, I went to Pepperdine Law School because they had a very good criminal law department, and my professors there were excellent.
Her first job after law school was with the Anchorage City Prosecutor's Office, fielding misdemeanor cases like thefts, assaults, and DUIs.
So I worked there for 7 years, and I enjoyed it tremendously. And then I went into private practice because of finances. I had student loans of $843 a month. I had a mortgage. I had daycare, car payments. And I simply, honestly, could not make ends meet. I had to stop being a prosecutor. I went into private practice. I was a criminal defense attorney for a long time.
You have a good reputation from the folks that I've talked to in criminal defense. You built up a good practice.
Yes, and thank you. And the thing about my private practice is that I could select the type of people that I would represent. I never represented anyone in any sex cases or any murder cases or any child abuse cases. I would never represent anyone in an animal abuse case. And so I was selective as to the type of people that I represented. And a lot of good law-abiding citizens can get in trouble, and they need good legal representation. And that's what I tried to provide.
How long have you been back with the state now? Or how long have you been with the state? This is
right.
The first time.
I have been back only since the beginning of January. But I want you to know that I was trying to go back for over a year. We had this financial crisis, and for a good part of the time that I wanted to go back to the state, there was actually a hiring freeze.
Right.
So when this opportunity came available in Dillingham is when I got hired. And okay. I got hired for this position.
Okay, let's talk about this position. The community learned not too many months ago here that the Dillingham DA's office was slated to be closed not long after the one prosecutor left here put in her resignation. And I think the perception was we're going to have cases are just going to be doled out to Anchorage district attorneys. We won't know who they are. We're probably not going to get as much attention, et cetera, et cetera.
That is not the reality, and Dillingham would not have been well served if that was the reality. There was a period of time before they hired somebody specifically to take on the Bristol Bay caseload where they did distribute the cases to very experienced prosecutors, but those prosecutors have big Anchorage caseloads. And the day that I started, I have all the Dillingham cases. I have every single morning. I live downtown every single morning. The first thing I go into the office and I look to see if there's any in custody arraignments. So you're covered 7 days a week. And my entire job is the Dillingham calendar.
During our interview, I raised again the concern that criminal cases in the Dillingham court won't get the same amount of attention as they used to, that the state will try to avoid costly trials, might deal down or quietly dismiss charges. Over the past month, we have watched drug cases and DUIs and others get dismissed, usually catching the police who investigated them completely off guard. I asked Dale if, for budget reasons or different perspectives, a less aggressive prosecution would be the norm.
I think the opposite is going to be the case. I personally am, I would say, a rather aggressive prosecutor.
I noticed. I think everybody in the court noticed this week.
And But respectfully, I mean, I'm not pretending to be something that I'm not. I care very much. I care about officer safety. I care about public order. I care about violence and that people can live their lives and have confrontations or arguments with people without having to worry about being physically assaulted. I care about drugs not infiltrating and ruining this community.
Will you be available to the public, to police, to victims, to defendants? Will the law enforcement be able to get a hold of you to help build cases? Will the public be able to get a hold of you to yell at you if they think it's not done right?
Yes. I have daily contact with law enforcement. And I've also told them, you know, I'm available 24/7 for calls anytime. I've told them that they cannot ask too much of me. I understand that the community would want their DA in the community, but I can also tell you that I do not believe that Dillingham is being sold short, having the Anchorage District Attorney's office handling this jurisdiction, because again, you have one assistant district attorney that's in charge of this, but I'm not my own boss. Jack McKenna's my boss. I have oversight, but I also have the resources to be able to successfully prosecute cases in Dillingham.
Okay.
Also, I want to say, you can expect me every single month. So there's no cutting corners. We're not going to be dismissing cases because we don't want to travel. And I just want you to know that I take this very seriously. And I just went to grand jury on someone who I think is a very serious offender. And I am confident that I will be in trial in the beginning of March. And I will be here as long as it takes.
We'll see you then. Pamela Dale, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
And finally this week, Cupid is going to have a workout this weekend, drawing back that bow and letting his arrows fly. Well, young lovers, listen up. Molly Dishner tracked down a few veterans of the old game of hearts seeking a little elder's advice and has this special Valentine's Day postcard.
Dave Balker.
And Johanna Balker, and we've been married 50 years.
51.
51?
Yeah.
You're right. You are right. I forgot. The secret is to marry somebody who's got the similar values you have, and that it's kind, you know, and this and that.
Well, our cooking has certainly gotten better.
Oh, my gosh. Is that the reason you're sticking around? Oh, no. Well, I'm sick of cooking. If I never had to cook again, I would be happy to do that.
Well, we had some wonderful kids, even though we lost one in an aircraft accident.
30 years ago.
I was busy most of the time working. Johanna took up the slack at home when I wasn't available, and she did a good job.
Dave's right, having wonderful kids, and now we've got wonderful grandchildren, and we're so thrilled about that. And that keeps us together, too.
Joanne Armstrong was married to her husband, Dick Armstrong, for 47 years, through summers of fishing and winters in town. Her advice? Be patient with one another.
And don't be so fast to break everything up, because everybody goes through ups and downs, and eventually things go up if they're down for a while.
Meg Schroeder says the words she and Hootie said to one another 44 years ago are what have kept them together ever since.
We've, you know, always been there for each other through thick and thin. I think the words that you say at your wedding kind of hold true for richer or poorer or through sickness and health. Plus, I think a lot of kindness and helping each other. To make it last, you treat each other with kindness, always help each other. It's amazing what a helping hand will do. When you're down or something's happening, they're always there by your side.
My name is Mary Olron, and I'm from Chivac.
My name is Ulrich Olron, I'm from Chivac.
And we've been married for 18 years now.
I'm from Chivac. She's from Mountain Village. She came to Chivac for Chivac Summer Festival, Eskimo Dancing and Basketball Tournament. She came to Chivac and...
It was love at first sight.
I just got done playing. I showered. I was heading out the door. I look up in the bleachers. I saw her sitting there. And then I just about face and I turned and sat next to her. And then we've been together ever since. Gotta love each other. Gotta be honest. And for me, it was always, I had to think of her feelings and not just mine. And communication. Gotta talk.
Yeah, and being patient and respectful. And to keep the culture in mind.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton. I'm Dave Benninger. Keep in touch, and we'll see you back here again on KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond next week.
Cupid, please hear my cry and let your arrow fly straight to my lover's heart.